WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps you've been following news stories about the 8 Brits who have been accused of spying for the Soviets during the Cold War. Those accusations are based on top-secret documents that were smuggled out of KGB files by a KGB archivist-turned-defector named Vasily Matrokhin. The contents of those smuggled documents are summarized for the public for the first time in the new book The Sword and the Shield, The Matrokhin Archive and the Secret History of the KGB. The book details Soviet spying and disinformation campaigns. My guest is Matrokhin's co-author, Christopher Andrew. He's the chair of the History Department at Cambridge University, a former visiting professor of national security at Harvard, and author of several books about international intelligence. I asked Andrew how Matrokhin managed to get the documents out of the KGB archive.
What happened was that Vasily Matrokhin, the archivist, who by the late 1960s was a secret dissident, in 1972 was put in charge of moving the whole Foreign Intelligence Archive from its cramped headquarters in the center of Moscow and the Lubyanka to a nice new greenfield site just beyond the Moscow Ring Road. He had to check all the files out from his office in the Lubyanka and check them all in at the new office. And during that period, and indeed for 2 years afterwards, took 10 years to make the move, he was able to note and copy anything that he wanted. And at the new end, there was a bizarre, but fortunately from my point of view, absolutely fatal error of security. Bags were checked, bodies weren't. So he was simply able to take out the notes which he took every day for 12 years in his pockets. It was as simple as that.
We've described how he managed to smuggle documents from the archive to his home, but how did he get trunkloads of documents out of the Soviet Union to the West?
Well, he thought of, after he retired in 1984, he thought of quite a number of methods, none of which actually worked, until the Soviet Union began to fall apart in 1991, 1992. Now, there was then a period in which some of the newly independent states, including the Baltic republics, had really rather easy access to the West, but a period during which the Russian Federation no longer had secure borders against the, or had yet to establish secure borders with the newly independent states. So even though it was taking great risk, he decided more or less on the spur of the moment to get on a train with a suitcase on wheels, which contained at the top sausages, and then other foodstuffs for his journey, and then various changes of clothing, and then at the very bottom, examples of his notes. Now, he appears to have gone into an American embassy in the Baltic states, and, you know, the CIA passed the opportunity up. I mean, I have to say I have some sympathy with them. If I'd been in the CIA station in one of the Baltic republics and somebody had come in and said, I have been copying the KGB's most secret archives for a period of 12 years, I had unrestricted access, and I've got some just below the sausages, I think I would have been fairly skeptical. Fortunately, however, he went also to a British embassy. Now, I come from the country of John Cleese, of whom I was an exact contemporary, the country of Monty Python. We expect life to be bizarre. And so if somebody says, I have the greatest secrets you've ever seen hidden beneath my clothes and sausages, you know, we're perhaps slightly more inclined to take that proposition seriously than people from cultures which run on more rational lines. The summer of 1992, he came over to Britain for just over a month, was debriefed, discussed during that period's methods, which he still will not talk about, of exfiltrating from Moscow himself, his family, and his entire archive. And the exfiltration was so successful that it was a long time before the SVR, the successor to KGB Foreign Intelligence, even realized that he had gone.
Well, let's discuss some of the findings in this archive that was smuggled out of Russia. Let's start with something that's of particular interest to Americans, the Kennedy assassination. You say that the archive showed that the KGB wanted to deflect responsibility for the assassination from Oswald. Why did they care about whether Oswald was seen as the guilty one or not?
Well, one of the things that the KGB was always very anxious to do was to think of any way that it could just to discredit American administrations and the way that the United States is governed generally. And it's always been very good at identifying conspiracy theories which play well in the United States. So it was actually the first to produce a book, even before the Warren Report came out, you know, within a year of Kennedy being assassinated in 1963. It actually published the first book, arguing that the JFK assassination was the result of a plot. Later on, it began to see opportunities to smear the Central Intelligence Agency. So what it did was that it began to forge the correspondence of Lee Harvey Oswald. So one of the consequences that of all this is that we now know that the so-called KGB files, which President Yeltsin handed over to President Clinton earlier this summer on the JFK assassination and Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, I think they are real documents, but they just leave out all the really interesting files. And I suspect that what happened is not that President Yeltsin consciously misled President Clinton, but that on this, as on a number of other occasions, Russian foreign intelligence has actually withheld the truth from the president of the Russian Federation.
You say that the KGB planted a story that Oswald had been selected as the assassin by a group of Texas financiers and industrialists headed by Howard Hunt. And this was after Hunt was implicated in the Watergate scandal. Do you think that they...
They got confused. You see, there were two Hunts. First, there was a Hunt who was a Texas oil millionaire, or for all I know, billionaire. Anyway, he had an awful lot of money. And then there was the Watergate conspirator. And actually, by the 1970s, they'd moved on to attempting to implicate the Hunt, who was a Watergate conspirator. And they forged a letter from Lee Harvey Oswald to Hunt, which made it appear that he was being used by Hunt to organize the assassination of JFK. And the forgery was so good. The KGB are probably the greatest forgers of the Cold War. I mean, they took months, if necessary, years on forging letters. So before they started forging Lee Harvey Oswald's correspondence, they made an intensive study of both the paper that he used, the way that he wrote, and for example, they noticed that he was dyslexic. Well, it didn't take them very long to notice that, but they made a careful study of words that he misspelled. And in this particular forged letter, for example, they spelt concerding, a D instead of an N, which is something that Lee Harvey Oswald did relatively often. And then they also got hold of samples of the notepaper that he had used in Texas. And after his return, and they forged the letter on that. And the forgery was so good, when it later emerged, it fooled even his widow.
Now, do you have any idea from reading through these KGB files what the KGB really thought happened in the Kennedy assassination?
I think the KGB really did think that JFK was killed as the result of a conspiracy, as indeed many Americans do. But the KGB were themselves the ultimate conspiracy theorists. Whenever anything went wrong that was against their interests or which they were likely to be blamed for, you know, they didn't assume that this was an accident. You know, it never occurred to them, for example, that American presidents, alas, are not infrequently the result of attempted assassinations. The KGB's natural tendency has always been to believe that when something happens that it's likely to be blamed for or that it doesn't wish to happen, that it is the result of a malign conspiracy.
Now, the documents show, you say, that the KGB tried to discredit Martin Luther King. What did it do to try to discredit King?
Well, first, why it attempted to discredit Martin Luther King. I think in the whole of the Cold War, there was probably no American that the KGB hated more than Martin Luther King. The reason that it hated him was simply that, you know, it was in favor of anything which would destabilize the United States. And in the mid and late 60s, the era of the long hot summers, or the beginning of the long hot summers, it based a lot of hope in race war. And the reason why it hated Martin Luther King was that it saw, probably rightly, Martin Luther King as the man most able to reconcile Americans. So how did it attempt to discredit him? Well, quite a subtle way. It knew that if it planted stories immediately in the American press, they might not have the maximum effect. So what it began to do was plant stories in the African press, which accused Martin Luther King of being an Uncle Tom, someone who was actually secretly being bribed by the White House, and according to one or two versions of it, personally, by President Lyndon Baines Johnson, to moderate, to emasculate the just demands of the black community. And then it calculated that these libels would be played back from African newspapers into African-American newspapers. But at that very point, Martin Luther King in 1968 was assassinated. And terrible, terrible, though it is to say it, that was a day of rejoicing in KGB headquarters.
You know, as the KGB was trying to discredit him, the FBI was also trying to discredit King. And this might be one of the rare instances where the KGB and the FBI were on the same page.
I'm afraid that's true. But, you know, the sorts of themes that were run during Martin Luther King's lifetime, that is to say, attempts to stir up race war in the United States, they continued after his death in different ways. I mean, we have quoted in the book the text of pamphlets circulated by the KGB purporting to come from white racist organizations at the time of the Los Angeles Olympics, which are headed Black Monkeys, and which say that, there are lynch mobs out to get black athletes at the Los Angeles Olympics. It was the same kind of appalling race hate propaganda which the KGB had been circulating in one way or another in the United States anonymously since the 1960s.
My guest is Christopher Andrew, co-author of The Sword and the Shield, based on secret documents smuggled out of the KGB archives. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Andrew. He's the chair of the History Department at Cambridge University and author of the new book, The Sword and the Shield, The Mitrokhin Archive and the Secret History of the KGB. And this book is based on many documents that were smuggled out of Russia by a former KGB archivist. What do you think were the most important anti-American activities that the KGB carried out?
Well, the KGB's main responsibility in the United States was to collect political intelligence, to collect the political, military, and other secrets of the United States. And secondly, to steal its technological, scientific, and military secrets. Now, I think that so far as collecting intelligence on what the American government was up to, it was very largely a failure during the Cold War. And the reason it was very largely a failure was that it was tremendously politically correct. It always feared to tell the Soviet leadership, which until Gorbachev never understood the West, anything which disturbed its misconceptions. So that, you know, I think the final judgment on how awful Soviet political intelligence was, so far as the United States is concerned, is when Gorbachev comes to power in 1985, within a few months of hearing all this ridiculous KGB distorted views of American policy, he tells him he doesn't want to hear any more of such rubbish. Will they kindly now start telling him what is actually going on? Now, the area where it was actually successful and where it, I think, made a real impact on the Cold War were stealing secrets from American defense contractors. You know, long before Aldrich Ames became a mercenary spy in the CIA, there were mercenary spies in the majority of immense American defense contractors. By the mid-1970s, there are 77 agents reporting on technological secrets of one kind or another from within the United States. Now, this has a major, major impact. The Soviet Union, in order to remain a state-of-the-art military superpower, was dependent, critically dependent, on getting hold of Western military technology. So it's a reasonable estimate that by 1980, 70% of Soviet advanced weapon systems were dependent in greater or lesser degree on American technology.
Do you think it's fair to say that in some ways the results from this archive make it seem that the KGB is at the same time both more sophisticated than we might have thought and more ridiculous than we might have thought?
Yes, I do. But I think the fundamental lesson is that it was quite different from a Western intelligence agency. I mean, I think the single biggest way of misunderstanding the Cold War is to assume that there was symmetry on both sides. I think that in any political system, a good rule of thumb for determining the importance that any governing bureaucracy attaches to any piece of information that comes in is this. If that piece of information came in the middle of the night, would you wake the president? Would you wake the Secretary of State? Would you wake the Secretary of Defense? Now, if you apply that test to the information obtained by the KGB, you can see that their hierarchy of importance was entirely different. For example, there was usually no higher priority for Soviet foreign intelligence, and as indeed for Soviet domestic intelligence, than wrecking the lives of dissidents, all those who attempted to oppose the Soviet system. And that included dissidents who had gone abroad, like the great cellist Rostropovich, like the writer Solzhenitsyn, like the chess player Korchnoi, like the ballet dancer Nureyev, and so on. Now, in November 1978, the Oslo station of the KGB in Norway, where the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded each year, woke the man in the ruling Soviet Politburo, chiefly responsible for preserving ideological orthodoxy, Mikhail Suslov. Why did it wake him? It woke him to pass on the good news that the dissident Yuri Orlov had not won the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, you know, Suslov didn't say, why are you waking me at 3 o'clock in the morning with this news? He congratulated them. Indeed, over the next few weeks, the KGB station in Oslo was showered with congratulations. Of course, in fact, it hadn't, I think, done anything really to secure the fact that Yuri Orlov has not won the Nobel Peace Prize. After Camp David, it was always going to be the Israeli and Egyptian leaders, Begin and Sadat.
Now, as a result of this book and a companion movie that's already been broadcast in England, several still living British spies have been named, people in England who spied for the KGB, including a now 87-year-old woman. How did you feel about naming names of people who were still living?
I had mixed feelings about it, but I think there are only two views that one can take. Either one takes the view that anyone who spied for Joseph Stalin has the right of privacy, at least until they're dead, and if their names have not come out, one shouldn't name them. And the other possibility is, well, actually, they don't have that right of privacy, and it is reasonable to identify them as having done so. Melita Norwood is extraordinarily unrepentant. She has said that if she had her time over, she would do it all again.
She's the 87, like the now 87-year-old woman.
I think her achievements have been underestimated for a number of reasons. I mean, the Cambridge Five, the Magnificent Five, so-called, Kim Philby and his friends, they joined the KGB for much the same reasons, you know, mistaken belief that Joseph Stalin was the future, represented some kind of hope for mankind instead of, you know, one of the nastiest dictators ever to rule anywhere in modern history. But they didn't carry on for nearly as long as Melita Norwood. Melita Norwood carries on spying for over 40 years and keeps her secrets much more effectively than Kim Philby and his friends. And throughout that period, she provides top-grade scientific and technological intelligence, not just about the British bomb, British atomic bomb, but about lots of other things as well. And by the way, that at the end of the Second World War, the most important secret Britain has is the British atomic bomb. It's so secret that the British Prime Minister at that time, Clement Attlee, didn't even tell most of his cabinet. So one of the reasons why, perhaps the main reason, why Joseph Stalin knew far more about the making of the British atomic bomb than most members of the Attlee government did in Britain was Melita Norwood. And unsurprisingly, the KGB gave her a whole series of awards. They really rated her, and I think they were right to do so.
Is there a debate going on now in England about whether the people who were just revealed as being spies or former spies should be punished now?
There is a debate. What I think has got rather lost sight of, is whether they can be punished. The problems are twofold. First, we know the contents of the KGB file on Melita Norwood. We know the contents of the KGB files on quite a number of other people. But in a British court of law, and I suspect that it's the same in American courts of law, if you produce the contents of somebody's file, you know, the court is going to say, where are the originals? And if you can't produce the original file, then it's not admissible evidence. And it's pretty unlikely that Boris Yeltsin's Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, is going to release the original file. The other problem is that it's not enough simply to say, oh, I admit it, I used to be a Soviet spy. In order to produce adequate evidence to convict you, you have to be reasonably precise and say, oh, well, on or about such and such a date, this is the material that I handed over, and on another such and such a date, I handed over that material. So I think the problem, so far as Melita Norwood is concerned, and other recently disclosed Soviet spies in Britain, is that the evidence is either, though perfectly satisfactory for non-legal purposes, is either non-admissible or too vague for legal purposes.
Have you exposed names of Americans who are spies?
Well, what we have done is to identify by code names a great many spies within the American defense industries, and it will require further research to uncover the exact identities of these individuals.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Andrew is the co-author of The Sword and the Shield, The Mitrokhin Archive, and The Secret History of the KGB. He chairs the History Department at Cambridge University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.